Welcome to a special debt ceiling edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm a very serious Ron Elving.
And I'm an XM Ken Rudin.
Let me just say, Ken,
yes,
that this is the most incredibly important crisis that brings this nation to the brink of complete economic disaster
that
we have had since the last one.
Since last week's podcast.
Since last week's
podcast. What has changed? What has happened since then?
Well, actually, something has changed.
Some things have changed.
That's right. The Gang of Six, whom we all know, are three Republicans and three Democrats in the United States Senate who have been negotiating with each other off and on for about 6 months, have put together a, quote, big package deal to reduce the deficit by about $4 trillion, make the president happy, and then persuade their colleagues in the Senate and maybe in the House to raise the debt ceiling and set the nation on the course toward a more orderly fiscal house.
So when would this be passed? Like, well, this week while we're doing the podcast?
Or possibly even during this recording of this podcast. No, actually, that's not true. It's going to take time to get it in legislative form. It's going to take time to get it through
the Senate.
They're
not going to do it by August 2nd.
And they are probably not going to be able to do it by August 2nd.
Okay, so it seems like when the plan by the Gang of Six suddenly had new life and you saw a lot of Republicans in the Senate, Lamar Alexander, others like that, saying we could live with this, we still haven't heard anything from the House Republicans who may be key to making this fail or pass.
Well, we've heard from some of the most conservative people in the House that they still don't like any kind of revenue increases, no tax increases, and we've heard from the Congressional Black Caucus saying they don't like the program cuts, and we've heard from Dennis Kucinich and others on the left side of the House saying they don't like the program cuts. I think we can count on there being anywhere from 50 to 100 votes against it in both parties, probably over 100 votes against it in the Republican Party. The question is, can you find 218 votes for it?
I'm sorry, 217 votes, because there is no Anthony Weiner and there's no Dean Heller. So because there are two missing members of the House, it's only 217 we need. What I thought was most encouraging, now I'm saying encouraging as if I have a point of view, and I probably do have a point of view, because I kind of think what happened with the TARP vote...
You have a 401k.
That's my apartment number.
That is your point of view.
Well...
Do you have a home mortgage?
No, I don't look at it that way.
You don't look at it that way.
I don't. Yeah.
Good.
I look at it what's best for... Well, see, there are two things. I think this is fascinating politics, but I don't think it's great for the economy of the country. So I'm kind of torn watching as an observer and as watching as somebody who has a financial stake in the success of this system.
You know, an interesting thing that's been going on here in the last several weeks is that the number of people in the country, or the percentage of people in the country who believe that it would be a bad thing if the debt ceiling were not raised, people who think it should be raised, it's a necessity, has risen rather dramatically.
Absolutely, right. And the thing is, what was encouraging is that House Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who clearly did not see eye to eye earlier when Boehner and Obama were trying to do this grand compromise or this grand bargain, whatever, they seem to be on the same page. And remember, as you've talked about in previous podcasts, Ron, when the first vote on TARP in 2008 and it went down to defeat, mm-hmm. and then the stock market just collapsed, mm-hmm. and then they had another vote, I think more and more Republicans are aware that there could be a tremendous psychological fallout if it goes down.
That's right. So more and more people are understanding that it could affect rates that they pay. It could affect their own 401ks and other investments if the debt ceiling were to be breached and if we defaulted then on our obligations as a country. So as that has become a more popular notion, people have started urging their members of Congress to compromise. And some people have started saying, you know, the Republicans are so adamant about no tax increases, that's a sticking point. And the percentage of people who think the Republicans are being more stubborn than the Democrats has also increased. When public opinion polls were saying the debt ceiling doesn't matter, or they were saying that default on our obligations didn't matter, there was very little ground for the responsible politician to stand on and say that it did.
And when a lot of the polls said that it was President Obama and the Democrats who were going to suffer from the poor handling of the economy, the Republicans at least had some justification in their minds, in their political minds, to sit back and say, well, it's their problem, it's their fault, it's their economy. But when polls, as you say, are showing the Republicans taking a much bigger hit, their intransigence being far bigger of an issue than what Obama's doing, then they may have to look at it a second way.
Okay, so bottom line on all of this is that the politics has shifted in the last several weeks, and that may actually be pushing people closer to a deal that could pull us back from the brink on August 2nd, whether it was a short-term deal to just last a few weeks or months, or whether it was the grand bargain, or whether it was some combination of the two that would keep us from defaulting. defaulting on the debt on August 2nd.
On a smaller plane, we saw what happened in Minnesota this week, where neither side got what it wanted. The Republicans in the state legislature, they control the legislature there for the first time in 40 years. Republicans really wanted a tremendous cutback in spending programs. They didn't get that. Governor Mark Dayton, a Democrat, first Democrat elected in 20 years in Minnesota, he wanted to tax the rich, is what we campaigned on in 2010. He didn't get that either. And a matter of fact, they probably pushed the problems ahead, but that shutdown that laid off 22,000 state workers, that closed the state parks, that canceled fishing licenses, all those things.
Now you're getting serious.
No, it exactly
now,
right.
Now you're getting down to
in a state
real...
like in Minnesota in the summer, no fishing licenses?
No fishing license. Right. You can fish, but you can't fish legally, and if you're caught, you can be prosecuted. This was a serious situation in Minnesota. I don't know what lessons exactly it gives us at the national level, partly because the issues were slightly different, but the issues were fundamentally similar, and I think the message that most people would take away would be neither side got everything it wanted or even the main things it wanted. Everybody had to agree to a compromise that was painful in all directions.
Getting back to Washington for 1 second, somebody just said that, look, ultimately Congress will never get blamed for this. It's the president who rises and falls on the economy, his handing on the economy. Now, I don't know if that works in this case.
Well, I think that it's true about the economy, but it isn't necessarily true about a debt ceiling crisis or about a deficit reduction crisis. If you go back to 95, 96 and the two government shutdowns that we had when Newt Gingrich was running the House and the Republicans controlled the Senate, but Bill Clinton was still president. In the end, I think Bill Clinton came out ahead on that, seemed like the more responsible party, and got a lead in the polls he never relinquished. On the other hand, he had a rising economy by the mid-90s, and that had as much to do with reelecting him as anything else. So if Barack Obama had as good an economy as Bill Clinton had in the mid-90s, he would be in much better shape for re-election. He's not in terrible shape as it is, but he would look much less vulnerable than he does right now if he had that kind of economy. So I do think the president gets the blame for the broader general economic conditions in the country.
Do we think, let's just say that the Gang of Six plan is implemented, that everything is fine, that they increase the debt limit and we don't default. Is this a lasting lesson? Is this a lasting crisis, or do we just go on to the next thing and people and the voters forget about it? Because in Washington, we're obsessed with this story. But does outside of this building, outside of this city, do people care?
I think people care about the results. I think people care about feeling as though the government is doing its basic job of handling the fiscal business of the country. I don't think they care about the details. I don't think they think quite as much about who's up and who's down and who's benefiting from it in terms of their personal careers as we do. But they do care about the ultimate result, and they do want to know that the government is getting out of the way of the recovery. And right now, there's a broad consensus in the country that somehow the profligacy of the government, not a new story, but a continuing story, is in the way of the recovery. It's making it more difficult for jobs to be created and for the economy to recover in general. Fairly or unfairly, the blame for that is going to attach to the president, and that's why he needs this deal, and it's also why the country needs the deal.
It seems like it's giving a lot of people in this country a headache.
All right. I know why you brought up headache, Ken, not only because I know you've been suffering from them this week, but because you know, and I know, that those headaches that you have suffered would not affect your effectiveness as Commander-in-Chief.
Well, it certainly hasn't affected my job as a podcast co-something, whatever I do here.
Let me just say that we have been flirting around the...
I like your hair, Ron.
We have been flirting around the question that is on most people's minds this week, which is, what is up with Michelle Bachmann? And she has said, I will never vote to raise the debt ceiling, even as public opinion has been increasingly concluding that the debt ceiling must be raised. She continues to appeal to the hardcore base of the Republican Party that says, never raise the debt ceiling.
You know, she was one of the 9 Republicans who voted against the thing passed in the House this week. Tremendous cuts in spending.
You mean with all these cuts in spending, all the cut, cap, and balance, because it was designed to raise the debt ceiling.
It was not strong enough.
Not tough enough. So that's one story that she's out there defining, if you will, one of the polar extremes of this issue. The other story about Michelle Bachmann, which unfortunately, in my opinion, has gotten a great deal of currency, is something that appeared on a conservative website run by a conservative advocate,
Tucker Carlson,
named Tucker Carlson. It's called The Daily Caller, and they ran a story largely based on anonymous, but with one named source, saying that Michelle Bachmann suffers from incapacitating migraine episodes that have sent her to the hospital, that have taken her away from her office for days at a time.
Which has not been refuted by Michelle Bachmann.
She says that the episodes are under control, right, that she hasn't missed votes.
She did have this medical procedure that part of the recovery included terrible migraines. I think she had an appendectomy or something like that. And she
appendicitis, yeah. That's right, leading to an appendectomy,
yeah,
exactly.
I don't know how which comes first between appendicitis and appendectomy, but it'll be in the appendix of my new book.
So then we can just cut it right out.
Yeah.
This is not, in my opinion, a fair shot, that this has come in from almost certainly detractors of Michelle Bachmann.
Former staffers, apparently.
Former staffers, and of course every campaign has denied having given this material to Tucker Carlson. Every campaign has said, no, it wasn't us. But, of course, all the campaigns are also eager to say, we don't really think that this should be an issue, whether or not she has the capacity and a medical, et cetera, et cetera.
Although Tim Pawlenty did say that the health and concern of our candidates is the public's business.
Tim Pawlenty has got to be, in some people's minds, the person who would benefit most from a loss of some momentum for Michelle Bachmann, because his own campaign, Iowa, Minnesota.
We're not blaming
I didn't
him,
say
right,
he was
I'm,
responsible. Okay. But if something bad were to happen to the Michelle Bachmann boomlet, which is very strong right now, she's running in the high teens. She's the only person threatening at all to Mitt Romney in the current polls. It's very early. Of course, we don't take these polls too seriously. But two major national polls that came out this week had Mitt Romney at 30%, Michelle Bachmann in the high teens. Tim Pawlenty is nowhere to be found.
Nowhere. No.
He's not happening. And so if he's about to be humiliated in the Ames straw poll, the Iowa straw poll on August 13th, that's not going to augur well. His campaign's not raising much money. And he really needs to not have Michelle Bachmann taking up all the oxygen in his part of the world.
See, my feeling is that it's actually Tim Pawlenty who has the headache. As a matter of fact, his staff came out this week and said that they're hoping for maybe a 6th or 7th place finish in the Ames straw poll. I mean, look, I understand low balling.
Of Minnesota?
But Tim Pawlenty,
right next door? He's 6th or 7th?
He's lived in Iowa, basically. His campaign has lived in Iowa for all these months. He's gotten his staffers and spending money and all that thing. If he's still mired in single digits, if he still finishes 5th or 6th, I mean, I don't like to write people off before their actual voting comes, but I can't see how that candidacy could be sustained.
It's very hard to see where the turnaround comes. This is a bit of a surprise. I think a lot of people thought that Tim Pawlenty would be more of a player.
I did.
And I don't think his problems began with Michelle Bachmann by any means. I think his campaign was disappointing before Michelle Bachmann got in, and it's only become more so.
Well, he had that debate.
With her challenge.
Everybody criticized him.
She was there, and he had a chance to be the headline in that debate by continuing his attack on Mitt Romney's health care plan.
Right.
Romney Care, and explicitly refused to do so. His own campaign acknowledged that that was a blunder. And she, at the same time, came on very strong and impressed a lot of people and seemed like she became the headline on that debate more than anybody else. So his problems are largely of his own making.
And is it possible that, I mean, here we are talking about being eclipsed. Could Michelle Bachmann be eclipsed by Rick Perry? We keep talking every week about what he's going to do. Does he have enough time to get in? But more and more, it seems like he is more and more serious. There's indications that his wife, Mrs. Perry, is completely in favor of it, unlike we saw with Mitch Daniels and perhaps Haley Barbour as well. He's meeting constantly with big money folks. And, you know, at first I kept thinking that maybe, I still don't know if Rick Perry's going to run or not. But the more I read about what people see in Rick Perry, it makes me think that he could really be a factor. And if Michelle Bachmann is partly responsible for the eclipsing of Tim Pawlenty, it's very possible that Rick Perry could damage Michelle Bachmann in some way.
I think he becomes certainly another person for everyone in the media to focus on and to talk about, and for social conservatives who feel that they have been to some degree eclipsed in this economic period of crisis. Those folks are looking around for somebody. A lot of them have rallied around Michelle Bachmann. They would have an option. They would have a real alternative in Rick Perry, at least temporarily. Now, Rick Perry's numbers in Texas, where he's been governor for 10 years, longer than anyone in history, are not that great. And people in Texas are not that eager to have him run for president, including Republicans. I'm not saying that they would necessarily not vote for him in a primary, but I'm saying they're not as enthusiastic about him as they were about George W. Bush at a comparable point 12 years ago. And that's going to make some difference. People are going to notice. But I basically agree with you. While all summer you and I have doubted that Rick Perry was that serious about getting in, he seems to have changed. The money question seems to be getting a positive answer. It's Texas. You can raise money oftentimes as a conservative politician in Texas by going to the big Texas industries. He's going to run on a pro-business kind of platform as well as a social conservative
creating
platform.
Creating jobs. I think the record of creating jobs in Texas is certainly enviable by many of many states.
Yes, compared to the rest of the country. And he's going to have a case to make, and he's going to probably be very tempted to make it, again, partly because the Republican field is not setting the country on fire. And he sees himself as possibly having an opportunity that 6 months or a year ago didn't seem open to him.
There was an article in the New York Times this week that basically talked about how Mitt Romney is the nominal front runner because he's leading in the polls, he has the most money, he's really focusing his attention on President Obama and not the rest of the Republican field. Sort of what like Hillary Clinton did in 2008 when she focused on Bush and the Republicans and really ignored the rest of the Democrats. But you wonder if he is too much thinking of himself as a front runner and not being engaged enough with Republican voters.
In recent weeks, he has done very little to make news. He has not been outspoken, particularly on the debt ceiling crisis. He's recused himself almost from certain kinds of involvement in the national discussion. He seems to be focusing on fundraising, which he needs to do because his numbers there are not as impressive as they should have been. So he seems to be taking care of the business that he sees as most important. I still think Mitt Romney looks pretty formidable at this juncture and looks like the guy to beat. We've talked oftentimes about Rick Perry and come to this sort of conclusion that we don't think he was real. Now we think he's at least a 50-50 to get in the race.
Minimum, yes.
Do you feel any differently about Rudy Giuliani, or is that still a totally faux candidacy? All right, I take that as your answer. And Sarah Palin, does she reconsider in late August, early September after the Iowa poll?
No.
No, I mean after the Iowa straw poll?
No.
I don't think she does either. I think that the recent little blip in Newsweek magazine had more to do with her movie coming out and trying to sell tickets. Not so many got sold. Not so many.
Look, I understand that the conversation all year long has been we have to wait until the Republican field is complete. I kind of think that with Rick Perry or without Rick Perry, that is the last remaining decision to be determined. I think then we focus on the real state of the Republican field, starting with August 13th in Ames, Iowa, which in the past has gotten rid of exemplary presidential candidates like Sam Brownback and Lamar Alexander and Elizabeth
Dole. Pat Buchanan. The last two Iowa straw polls were in 2007 and 1999. And the same candidate finished in 10th place both times.
Was it John McCain?
Yes, it was.
Whatever happened to him?
I don't remember.
One name also that we shouldn't forget about is Elizabeth Warren. She didn't get the job she wanted at the Consumer Protection Agency that she helped develop, but that may be good news for Massachusetts Democrats.
Yeah, because they're trying to talk her into running against Scott Brown, and they don't really have they've got half a dozen candidates, but none that really looks like a threat to Scott Brown.
Correct.
Elizabeth Warren would change the chemistry and the dynamic of that race pretty quickly. Don't know that she would beat Scott Brown, who seems to be keeping his numbers up pretty well.
Yes, and he also has almost $10 million in the bank. And
those are the numbers I was referring to.
Yes, and I don't know if it's a woman thing in Massachusetts, but I should point out that Massachusetts has never elected a woman to the Senate or to the governorship. Of course, James Swift was governor, but by succession and not elected to the position. So, but the thing is, as you say, the Democrats who are in the race right now are either not raising money or not raising anybody's attention. And Scott Brown, in overwhelmingly Massachusetts, is still doing well. A lot of Democrats, I understand, are waiting out the Scott Brown race and wondering if John Kerry will be Secretary of State in a second Obama term. And then maybe that's what the race they're looking at. But right now, they don't seem extremely eager to go after Scott Brown.
Not Scott Brown and his $10 million. But the Republicans are doing pretty well at recruiting candidates for statewide races, for Senate races, and for governorships around the country. Not too surprising, looking at the state of the economy. What about Texas?
Well, they got David Dewhurst, Lieutenant Governor of Texas. As you know, as everybody knows, Lieutenant Governor is the top, the most powerful position.
As everyone knows, but Rick Perry.
Exactly, or George W. Bush. I mean, Lieutenant Governor, well, although Rick Perry was Lieutenant Governor under George W. Bush. But anyway, David Dewhurst, Lieutenant Governor, goes in now in the favorite to win Kay Bailey Hutchinson's seat. And in Michigan, even though I still think that incumbent Democrat Debbie Stabenow was favored to win another term, Pete Hoekstra, the former congressman who ran for governor, lost in the primary in 2010, changed his mind and said he would seek the Republican nomination against Stabenow. So that's at least an interesting interesting race, although I think she still wins.
All right. And just real quickly, as we close, in the state of Wisconsin, the first recall election was held this week, and incumbent Democrat Dave Hansen was able to stave off a recall effort. The rest of the summer,
it wasn't even close, by the way.
It was 69%.
And it was not unexpected. That was
a district where he did not draw the toughest opponent. Now, there are two other Democrats who are still subject to recall in later votes this summer.
And six Republicans.
If the Democrats were to net a total of three seats, they would take back control of the state Senate there in Wisconsin. And, of course, this is all seen in some respects as a dry run or a preparation for the larger recall election against Governor Scott Walker, which will be next year.
Yes, and the remaining recall elections in Wisconsin, the ones we just talked about, will take place next month.
And that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week when we hope we will have some news on the debt ceiling crisis we know you are all following on It's All Politics from NPR.